He's had his shining moment, but a life after that as well. Last week, we talked about the events that led him to the most historic shot in the history of the NCAA basketball tournament. But that wasn't the beginning of his basketball drama, and it was hardly the end either. He returned for another year of college basketball, a disappointing year at that, and then tried to make it in the NBA. And he did, ever so briefly. He then hung in there for several years in the crazy minor leagues of professional basketball, and then merged into a coaching career. Unlike that moment when he hit the game-winning shot in the tournament, fate and circumstance have never quite aligned for him as a coach. But he hasn't given up yet on the hope of coaching a team with the potential, at least, to do what he helped one do in the NCAA tournament 27 years ago, when he had a game that people won't let him forget, even today. There's more to this story, so let's go. I'm Mark Monteith, and once again, I'm going one-on-one with Keith Smart.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Welcome to part two of the conversation with Keith Smart. Last week, we took his story up to the moment he was just about ready to let go of the shot that would propel him into NCAA history. So let's resume the story now and let him describe his date with destiny. When you took that game-winning shot, you know, this is a cliche question, but is anything going through your mind? Did you have any hesitation at all about taking the shot? Or did you know that, hey, we got to get a shot up here pretty quickly? Anything at all you recall about your mindset at that time?
I didn't hear anything. I didn't have time. I didn't know how much time. I didn't see time. I didn't understand. We got the rebound. I didn't realize how much time we had to work with, you know. I know we got the ball. We got the possession. You know, Syracuse is not going to foul us. They're going to play straight defense. So I knew, didn't think of the fact that by the time I got the ball again at 5 seconds, that I'm coming down to the wire to taking a shot to win or lose the game. If I would have thought of that, then maybe I would have been so afraid to take the shot that I would have been paralyzed to make a play. But I think because I was so clear in what was happening on the floor, I had taken a shot earlier from the right side of the floor, and I didn't get the right lift on it. And something that Ron Felling would always shout or preach, jump up, shoot up, at practice or in games, you know, which would put automatic arc on the ball if you jump up, shoot up, and something that I use in my teaching now. So I knew if I got the chance again that I knew I had to get some lift. And here I was floating to a baseline, a place on Nicholson Elementary in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or another place called Westdale, that we would end the games for that day, playing on the blacktops, by shooting a baseline jumper and falling out of bounds.
Wow.
And here we were, and here was the opportunity that I had a chance to do that on that stage and falling in. And the joke that we had as youngsters was that we would fall out of bounds and fall into the arms of the cheerleaders that would sit along the baseline. So that was the intriguing part of shooting that shot from the baseline and falling into the stands, you know. And here I was with a moment, and I took the shot and drifted out of bounds.
But there are no cheerleaders waiting for you.
You know, right. You know, who moved those cheerleaders?
Man, if there was ever a fateful shot, that was it. I mean, you dreamed about the moment, and you had practiced the baseline shot falling out of bounds. It seems like you had prepared your whole life for that moment.
Oh, yeah. I think when I deal with young people and I say, you know, you have to just continue to be prepared for life. Be prepared for moments that you have no idea are coming your way. And so when you prepare for those situations, when Lester Roberts had asked me if I wanted to have a chance to go to college and play basketball, and I would have said no, we'd never get to this point here, have a chance to be part of a national championship team. You know, things that every kid that goes to college, boy or girl, the thing that they want more than anything else, obviously getting an education, but on top of that, getting a moment to where they can win a championship in their chosen field. And so I get an opportunity to do that. But it was all because preparation finally met the opportunity. And an opportunity for me that year was to take a shot and make that shot. You know, Damon Bailey, I coached him in Fort Wayne in the minor league, the CBA. And he would joke all the time. Because for some reason, these guys thought I couldn't shoot, you know. And they would always joke, isn't it amazing? The guy that couldn't shoot made a shot to win the whole thing. And I said, guys, you forget that I could shoot the basketball. The problem was I couldn't shoot when I wanted to when I was at Indiana because Coach Knight wouldn't allow us to do it all the time, you know. But yeah. But it was a great moment for my teammates as well.
So what do you remember about the post-game celebration?
Well, I remember right away as the shot goes in, and Syracuse obviously, you know, they debate back and forth that they try calling a timeout, but you look at all the clips and you don't see anything like that. You see Greg Monroe gesturing to call the timeout as if to ask the question, do we call it? And, of course, I don't know why they even stopped the clock because no one called a timeout.
Right.
You know, so I remember when that happened, I remember going to the bench and I remember putting up a finger saying, there's 1 second left, 1 second left. And, you know, a lot of things have happened, you know, crazy things have happened with limited time on the clock. So I knew then. But one thing that I noticed was Derek Coleman taking the ball out of bounds. And he was going to throw a long full court pass. And Derek was a left-hander, but I saw him throwing the ball with his right hand, inbounding. And I remember that most guys who are kind of, you know, play with one hand but use the other hand on occasion, that ball has a tendency to curve out. And I positioned myself to be able to go and get that ball. And I went up and got that basketball at the end. And I threw it up in the stands. And believe it or not, I had no idea where my parents were sitting in the game. Didn't know where their tickets were going to be. And I threw the ball, and the ball went in the direction, in the stands, over the heads of my brothers. They were sitting in the stands.
Mm. I was going to ask who caught that ball. Do you know?
What I heard, it was a guy behind him that caught the ball, and Coach Knight, as they said, made it a point that he gets that basketball, that he get that basketball back. And they say he got it. I don't know if he did, but that's what the rumor was, that he did get that ball back.
But you almost threw it to your brother.
I almost threw it right to them. You know, almost threw it to them.
Wow.
Know? And I remember my youngest brother hearing what Brent Musburger was saying, you know, Indiana wins the championship and Keith Smart's the hero.
Indiana wins the championship. Keith Smart is the hero.
And I remember him being so young back at the hotel and screaming, you know, Keith Smart the hero, Keith Smart the hero, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was glad that they got a chance to witness that. I wasn't somewhere so far away that they never would have had a chance to enjoy that excitement. But that was a great moment for us and all the fans that had a chance to witness and be a part of that. And then, you know, once we hit the floor, I remember thinking back when I got cut from the high school team and thinking back to, you know, Nolan Richardson said something to me when I made the decision to go to Indiana. He said that, you know, you probably wouldn't even be able to play in the Big Ten. You know, those big guys are going to hit you with those screens. You wouldn't be able to play there. Mm-hmm. And I never forget walking off the night after we beat UNLV, coming off the floor, I saw him up in the stands. It was right over the doorway when we went into the tunnel to go to the locker rooms. And then I saw him again on championship night. And I said, man. So I remember all those little moments there, you know, not making the team. You know, getting cut from the team, those little things like that, and missing out on the state championship my junior year.
Yeah.
And so it was a moment that I kind of recaptured by winning the national championship.
Yeah. Now, you say Coach Knight got the ball back. Did he get the ball that you had hit the game-winning shot with? Did that come back?
I have no idea. Okay. I heard he did, but I don't know if it was true or not. And he may have it, but I never asked him about it, but the talk was that he had someone go and get that ball, he had that ball.
But he didn't give it to you. You don't have it.
No. Didn't give it to me.
What about that night? Are you out on Bourbon Street that night celebrating? Or what do you do to celebrate a national championship like that?
Well, obviously you were in one of the greatest cities in the world for hosting and partying. And so here's the deal. My two friends, one was my cousin and the other was my best friend. So they were coming to the game, but they got a flat tire. My cousin's car ended up getting a flat tire. And so, of course, then you don't have the cell phones and everything that you can tell someone that you have a flat. Well, he had a flat on the bridge that will bring you from Baton Rouge up into New Orleans, and the Lake Pontchartrain Bridge. And what happened, he didn't have a spare. So they're stuck on the bridge. Never made it to the game. So I waited for them, thinking that they would be coming to the game, but I didn't hear from them. We went after the game. We had a team meal, and we're all sitting there, and you know, everyone's ready to go out and party, go have some fun on Bourbon Street. And so we're thinking, man, we're not going to get a chance to go out. So Coach Knight said, "Listen, guys, I just want you to know one thing. You know, sure, you guys know, you know, you have no idea what you've done." But you won't start really paying attention to it until it's 10, 15, 20 years later when you start to see this, and your kids or grandkids, you know, later on will be able to see this thing, that you guys are part of a national championship. And he said, "I just want you to understand, when you go out, leave this room tonight, just know that you are representing yourselves, your family, Indiana University, and this basketball team. The bus leaves at 7 in the morning." When he said that, everyone jumped up and ran out of the meal room and went to their rooms and got quickly changed and was getting ready to go out. And so I'm still waiting for a phone call or a message or something from my cousins, and I didn't hear anything. And so finally I decided to go out on Bourbon Street and walk around. But as I'm walking around, a couple guys, some Syracuse fans, some Indiana fans, started arguing. And next thing you know, they started scuffling a little bit. And so I turned around and went back to my room, and I didn't get a chance to go out.
Really? You just thought it was too crazy out there?
Yeah,
and you
went back to your room. Yeah, it was just crazy. And so I just went back to my room, and that was it.
You sat in the room by yourself all night, just kind of reflecting on the championship.
That was it.
Wow.
So my mom and dad came by. Lester Roberts came by. He's no longer with it. He's passed away now. But he came by the room, and we talked, and there was a local news team that came by the room, and I got a chance to do a little story on the Sports Academy and with my mom and dad and everything, and they left, and there I was by myself. My roommate, Dave Miner, the guy that slept all night, he was gone.
He was resting.
So they were all out, you know.
Yeah.
And I never forget, the next morning we got up and got to the bus, and, you know, obviously no one had really slept at all. And I never forget, we got on the bus. They counted all the heads to make sure everybody was there, and one person was missing, Dan Dockage. And Dan had just missed the bus. And Coach said, well, we saw him, and Coach said, "Just drive off." And so the bus started to drive off, leaving Dan. And there he was running down the street with his suitcases, trying to catch up to the bus, and he fell. And the bus just cracked up, you know, just cracked up. And he eventually got a taxi to the airport, and then we flew back to Bloomington.
Smart returns for a senior season at IU and then gets drafted into the NBA when One-on-One continues. But first, here's Don Fisher's call of Smart's historic game-winning basket in the final seconds of the 1987 NCAA championship game.
Indiana with a chance to win. They're down by one. 24 seconds to go. Here is Keith Smart. Smart back out to Hillman. The clock down to 18. The Hoosiers look like they're going for the last shot. Now off to Smart. Alford trying to work himself free. Smart down low to Daryl Thomas. 8 seconds to go. Out to Smart. Baseline jump shot in the air. Good! 4 seconds, 3 seconds, 2 seconds, one. Now they baseball it up the floor. Here's a jump play. Keith Smart intercepts and Indiana wins. The Hoosiers have won the national championship.
Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with part two of my conversation with IU's NCAA tournament hero, Keith Smart. After playing a starring role in the Hoosiers Championship in 1987, he had to come back for his senior season. To say the least, that one didn't go as well. But he was still drafted into the NBA, where he began a playing odyssey that would last 9 years. What a lot of people forget is that you still had another year of college basketball.
Yeah.
You know, you had a senior year coming up. Mm-hmm. Was it difficult following up on that? I mean, for you individually, having had that glory and that moment that you'd literally dreamed about for so long, mm-hmm. was it difficult to come back that next year with the same amount of drive and motivation?
Well, see, I you know, because Razzback, we won a championship. We had 2 weeks off, and then Dean and I got invited to go to the Pan American Games, and then in Colorado Springs. You know, I go from the Jones Cup with the national team that played over in Taipei, Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
I arrive in Bloomington. I have, I think, maybe 2 weeks. Rick Calloway and I flew straight from Taipei from there. Had about 2 weeks, or 2.5 weeks, and right into school. You know, as school started, right into basketball, having a long season all the way to the finals. And then 2 weeks after that, I go right into the Pan American trials, and then we make the team.
Yep.
And then from the Pan American games, we go right into the games right there in Indianapolis again. So all this stuff is happening, and it's local, you know. So the games are right there in Indianapolis, and we end up losing the gold medal to Brazil.
Oscar Schmidt,
you know. And I never forget his favorite words, you know, hey, there are a lot of people that play that carry the piano, but only one guy plays it.
Yep, I remember that too.
I'm the one that plays it. So, and I ended up playing against him over in Europe. And,
oh, yeah?
And so.
He just went in the Hall of Fame, you know, like a year or two ago. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, you go through all of that, and then you come right back into your senior year. And I think I hit the wall. I think I was tired. I think, because I didn't have any rest. And, of course, I didn't start off playing how I, you know, needed to play. And then I'll never forget this. And Coach shared that our team didn't have any leadership. And to this day, that still haunts me because I felt I didn't carry myself the way Alfred did, you know, on the off the floor, you know, with his leadership toward the team. And, you know, just I thought the leadership part of that was getting on guys when we weren't playing hard because I assumed that they wanted me to be a bit more vocal my senior year. And that was a big step for me because that wasn't my personality. But leadership in other places, you know, when we started preseason in that year of 87 and we started conditioning, you know, I think I'm faster than Alfred. I think I'm a better athlete than Alfred. But I could not beat that guy when we did our conditioning drills. I mean, he was in such great conditioning that, you know, his conditioning pushed him over the top. We ran 110s and 220s, and you had to do it in a certain amount of time, and I could not beat him. I could not beat him. I mean, I tried to beat him, but couldn't do it. And that next year, it was my turn, Dean's turn, and Steve Isles' turn to lead like that. And although I was the guy that looked upon to be the one to fall into the role of Alfred, I didn't handle it very well. And not from the attention, because I didn't care about the attention. That never went to my head, anything like that. But I just didn't feel that I led our basketball team the way it needed to be led. And for the most part, I think that really hurt our team that year, and we didn't play well. And our team was the defending national champion, but that group of players, we were not the national champion. So we missed a lot with those three seniors, Darryl Thomas, Steve Alford, and Todd Meyer. And more than anything, we missed their leadership. I think if I had another year at Indiana, I think I would have been able to bounce back and be in a much better position than we were when we got knocked out by Richmond.
Yeah, you were just kind of burned out.
Yeah.
For that particular year.
Because I felt that, you know, everything I was working hard, but I felt like I wasn't getting anything done. And then later, you know, in Coach Knight doing my senior year, I got benched for about five games. And that might have helped me a great deal because then I finished my senior year pretty well. But I think I may have been able to take some of the pressure off of being mentally drained that it really helped me later on.
Okay. And I think you lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament that year, right?
Yep. We lost in the first round, lost to the Richmond Spider.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get a chance to get a chance to take the shot again this year. I missed it at the end. You know, the year before I made it to win it, and that had the last shot that year, and the ball didn't bounce my way. And,
yeah.
And that was the end of my senior year.
And you're a second-round draft pick in the NBA draft of the San Antonio Spurs. I'm trying to remember in 19... Golden State. Okay,
yeah.
That's right. You wound up playing for San Antonio, but you were drafted by Golden State.
Right.
And I'm trying to recall what it was like then in 1988. Mm-hmm. You did they have a pre-draft camp and all that stuff?
Yeah, we had. There were two pre-draft camps. One was in Orlando, and unlike now, where the top players are players that they don't really play anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, they go there for just watch them do layups. But we had actual games. And so there was one in Orlando, used to be called the Orlando Classic. And so myself and Dean went down there to play, and I played very well in that Classic and made the all-tournament team, and then thought that I was done with any type of workouts. We didn't travel around to go to NBA teams and work out for each for teams that want to see you like they do now.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't get that opportunity. Played well, and eventually from there, got the chance to go back to school to try and start finishing up. But then I got a phone call that I need to go to Chicago, and play. But I had already gone into training and stopped training because I felt I was done. And my agent told me, you were done. You don't have to do anything else until later. And eventually I went to Chicago and got with a bad team, which they said could possibly happen because – you're dealing with now some players who weren't invited to the Orlando Classic and were kind of last-minute throw-ins, and I played with a bad team, and I didn't play well, and obviously I ended up slipping in the draft and ended up being chosen the second round.
Were you watching this on television? Or?
Yeah, it was televised, and myself and Dean were in my apartment, in our apartment at Varsity Villa in Bloomington. And first round, you know, my name was mentioned that here are some guards that were still on the board. That haven't been chosen yet. We were still in the first round, and my name was mentioned that looking at here's a possible first round that's going to come up. And then obviously the first round passed through, and then as we started moving into the second round, then finally my name got called at number 41.
Now, in today's environment, you probably would have come out for the draft after your junior year. You know, after you'd hit that game-winning shot in the championship game, you come out then, you're almost automatically a first-round pick.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing that was interesting was that I never thought about going pro at that time. You know, it never entered my mind. My focus was coming back my senior year and playing, being in a role that coach said, you know, I want him to be in the role that Alford was in. So I never thought like that, you know, like they do today. And people would joke, say, man, you should have hit that shot and ran straight to New York and waited for the draft, you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't think that way. And so I just felt that I wanted a chance to be able to try out for the Olympic team the next year because that was coming up next. Because from being in the program with the USA
mm-hmm.
basketball, that I had a chance to go to Olympic trials. So all those things were in my mind. Plus, Steve Alford had played on the Olympic team. You know, I kind of wanted to do those things. I wanted to be an All-American, all those things there. So it never entered my mind. And they say had you come out your junior year, you'd probably have been in the top 10 – you know, because of what you had done.
Yeah.
But it didn't work that way. And so I ended up getting picked in the second round and eventually got on the highway from Bloomington and drove out here to California.
Drove out to California by yourself,
drove out to California.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing some great, great parts of the country. And I remember stopping at the various gas stations and getting bags of ice to keep myself awake driving and put them on my face, put them in my pants and everything just to try and stay awake because I drove through some desolate places trying to get all the way out here.
Did you drive straight through? I mean, you stopped, didn't you?
I stopped and stayed over a day here, you know, stayed over at a hotel, motel here. But for the most part, I drove all the way by myself.
You didn't do any sightseeing, huh?
No. I stopped in of all places, Garden City, Kansas.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I stopped there, visited with a family that was there, visited with my coaches that were there, and then I continued my drive out to the Bay Area.
You're a shooting star all those years.
Smart gets a cup of coffee in the NBA. or really more like a sip. But he milks all he can from his playing career when one-on-one continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with an IU basketball legend, Keith Smart. His NBA playing career didn't last long, to say the least, but he's got some fond memories of it, which is good because he doesn't have much memorabilia from it. So how did it go with Golden State? You didn't make the team. Were you released in the preseason? Or?
I was released right in preseason. I got there, and Coach Nelson, of all the people, and of course I ended up working for him as a coach for 6 years, but Coach got there and started playing and came to realize, how pros carry themselves. And I got in camp, and I think from playing in a motion-type offense, and now having to adjust to playing more of a creative one-on-one style, kind of the style that I had coming to Indiana. And then I, was able to let that go a little bit and play in the system that we had at Indiana. But then once I got to the pros, I was looking for more of that type of offense, but Golden State was more of a creative type team, players making plays for themselves. And that was the NBA. And they needed a point guard, a guy who, position-wise, that's what he played. Mm-hmm. And I didn't play that position 100%, but I started to adjust to play it. But I think Coach Nelson wanted that. And I'll never forget the day I got released. Coach came over to me and said, well, hey, he didn't say to me, hey, look, you really should be on this team. We want you to be here. But unfortunately, we can't. He just came to me and said, hey, you're not going to make our team, and walked off. And that was it.
Wow. So thanks, Coach.
I'm shooting free throws. We're shooting free throws at the end of practice. So I don't know, do I finish shooting my free throws? Because you had to shoot a certain amount after each practice. What do I do now? What's next? Like today, when something happens, right away the players are on the phone with their agents right away. Well, you didn't have that luxury. You don't have the cell phone. Had to wait, get showered, walk around the practice facility in a daze, and then get in your car and drive back to your apartment or hotel room, and then eventually call your agent. And, of course, my agent, is on the other side of the country. So I had to wait for the right time to connect with him, and then finally I got a hold of him, told him I had been released, and he said, well, I'll tell you what, just sit right there, just wait. We'll see what's going to happen next. And I waited in Oakland for another 3 days, and nothing had happened. And then I decided to go visit Dean Garrett, who was over in Phoenix. So I went to visit him in Phoenix, and from there I got the phone call that San Antonio, they were picking me up.
Okay, and this is still in the preseason.
It's still preseason.
Yeah. Now, is Larry Brown coaching there yet?
Yeah, Larry Brown was coaching.
Okay. Okay, and, must have been his first year there probably.
Yeah, it was his first year. And all right. So he picked me up and brought me in, and along myself, Willie Anderson was the first-round pick there, Sheldon Jones, Vernon Maxwell. And so here we were, all four rookies on a team, on a young basketball team. And David Robinson, who still had his military commitment, so he wasn't there yet. So we were there playing, and obviously the season wasn't going the way we needed to go. And Larry Brown said, Keith, I'm going to have to release you, but I want you to go play in the minor leagues. And if something happens to one of our players, I'll call you back up. And so I got released there and went home, and nothing happened for a while. And then finally decided to go play in the minor leagues, waiting for a phone call again for something to happen. And by that time, I had gotten out of shape, and finally my agent said, you need to go and start playing. So we need to get you into a CBA team at that time, they were called.
Yeah.
And I go out to Iowa for the Cedar Rapids Silver Bullets.
Mm.
And I'm playing there, and from playing there, Alvin Gentry, the assistant coach, I came out one night, and I saw him in the hallway of the arena. And I said, man, what are you doing here? And he said, hey, Larry Brown sent me here to see you, and I'm coming to check you out. And he said, because Johnny Dawkins just got hurt. And Larry said, go check on Keith to see how he's doing. Now, I had just come back and started getting into this, so I'm out of shape. I gained weight, everything. And I never got the call again to go back up.
Mm.
And so that was kind of it.
Yeah, but you did play in two NBA games, correct?
Yep, played in two, was there for six games, but only played in two of them.
Okay.
I tell the joke with the San Antonio people that I have the best free throw percentage in the history of your team, because I think I was 2 for 2.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you had scored 2 points, so they're on free throws, huh?
Right, yep.
Okay. Who'd you play against?
Oh, my goodness. I never forget, my first game was against the Lakers. And I never forget, because I had the same agent as Magic Johnson and Isaiah Thomas. You know, so I had
that guy from Detroit.
Yes. Bill Merriweather and Dr. Tucker.
Yeah, well, Willie Merriweather's from Indianapolis.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And he actually now he lives in San Antonio, Texas now.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I did a show with him last summer.
Okay. You know, so when we got into the game, I'm on the bench, and I never forget. Coach Brown called me to go in, and he says, "Go in for Johnny Dawkins." So I go in the game, but I'm not paying attention. I'm going to the scores table, but I'm not really paying attention. I'm watching the game. I see on the floor Magic, obviously, Kareem, James Worthy, Byron Scott, you know, all these great players on the floor. And so I get there, and I'm thinking, okay, who's Johnny guarding? And then finally I look over, and he's guarding Magic. So the horn sounds for me to go into the game, and I go into the game, and all of a sudden, I'm on Magic, and I'm going down the floor, and all I hear is mouse in the house. You know, mouse in the house, which automatically Magic went to the post, posted up. They threw the ball to him. He made a quick spin move, and he laid the ball up. And when he laid the ball up, there was a foul call, in which I didn't touch him, but there was a foul call. And the next time down, I'm guarding him. And he said, now, look, if you're going to make it in this league, you can't act like you're afraid to play. And he's telling me this while we're playing.
Wow.
You know, so that was a game, the team that I played in. I got a foul, and I ended up scoring, making 2 free throws.
Okay. Do you happen to have a tape of that game?
Well, I'll tell you, the unfortunate thing with all my memorabilia is that everything got destroyed in a fire.
Really? Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, we lost our house. I had a house in Bloomington, and there was a huge fire out at the Point. I had a condo at the Point because I was still playing, and that was my off-season place. And there was a huge fire out there, and 23 out of 29 homes got destroyed that particular night.
Mm.
And my condo was one of them that went up in smoke. So everything that I had ever had went up in smoke that night. And that summer, I had gone home to get all the stuff that my mom had kept for me over the years, and all that was gone.
So do you have a picture of the shot hanging on the wall at your house somewhere?
Yep. Yeah. Actually, you know, I met the lady. Her brother was a guy who actually took the picture of the shot.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she lives in Clarksville, Indiana, and we were able to get the rights to that. And so I did have an opportunity to get the shot photo.
Smart continues his playing career in the minor leagues and then finds his way into coaching when One-on-One continues. We're back on One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with former IU star Keith Smart. His NBA playing career didn't quite turn out like he hoped, but he didn't quit on the dream. He played for several professional teams in the American minor leagues, the Philippines, and Europe, but he never quite got back to the NBA, at least as a player. But he certainly got there as a coach. You mentioned your minor league journey, and you really had one. You know, yeah. Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Mm-hmm. You're in the Philippines, right, for a while?
Oh, yeah, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Then I went from there. Then, you know, after my chance to get called back up to San Antonio, my agent got me a job to go over to the Philippines. He felt it'd be a good situation to go play and get in great shape over there and then try to come back here later. And then from there, I ended up playing, went to various NBA camps. Then I went to Rapid City, South Dakota, played in the World Basketball League in Worcester, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Erie, Pennsylvania, won a championship with Youngstown, Ohio, of the Youngstown Pride in the World Basketball League. And then obviously played over in Europe, played in France, played on the same team for 3 years over there. Played in South America, played in Venezuela, was down in the Dominican, and then eventually coming back to start coaching in the CBA, played in the CBA in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and then eventually getting a chance to start coaching there.
Right. You know, anyone I've ever talked to who played in the CBA or some of these minor leagues mm-hmm. has stories, because it's pretty crazy. Right. What stands yeah. out as your best stories for minor league basketball? Because I've heard all kinds of things. You got to have some.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, obviously you see guys get upset because it's such a self, at that time, it was such a selfish league because you yeah. had to score to get a call to get out of there. And I remember two guys got into a huge fight. We were playing in Albany, New York, against the Albany Patroons. And these two guys are walking down the stairs. They start this unbelievable fight. I mean, they are fighting, falling down the stairs. We go to the locker room. They're fighting in the locker room. We come out of the locker room, didn't discuss anything about the game. These two guys are scratched up, bloody, knocked on their heads, and start playing the game. No problem, you know, as if nothing happened, you know.
Yeah.
So you had things like that, you know, traveling by bus.
Yeah.
One time there was a bus. We were traveling from Fort Wayne, Indiana, going to Michigan to play a game up there. But the bus, the heating system went out on the bus. So we go there with no heat, and it's freezing. So, I mean, it's so cold that ice now is forming inside the bus. You know, so we drive up there, play the game. They say they got the heat fixed for us to come back home. We went to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Well, now they can't turn the heat off. So now the bus is burning up on the way back. So you literally have players sitting on the bus. And, of course, you play cards and all that stuff to kill time. You literally have players sitting there in their underwear on the bus driving back, you know.
Yeah.
So little things like that, players getting traded, coaches trading players and say, I'll give you a pair of sweats for this player.
You know,
like
Troy
that.
Lewis told me that story, that somebody got traded for a pair of sweats.
A pair of sweats, you know, things like that. You know, all the fun games, watching, and this was funny, but this guy – the mascot in Fort Wayne, this guy was coming down from the ceiling, you know, and the next thing you know, the rope or something broke, and he fell. And this guy bounced from hit the floor and went as high as the basket. And you thought this guy should have been killed, you know, but he actually survived. I mean, he survived. Yeah. Had a few, you know, broken vertebrae, but he survived. And,
wow.
But, you know, seeing that, watching this guy do it every night there, And you're watching him, all of a sudden he falls. And,
yeah.
And, you know, in amazement. Then you had to play a game after that, because now they have to come on the floor. You know, the ambulance and everything couldn't move him, and you got to play a game. Mm. Another situation happened where a player had some issues with the law for not paying child support. He plays the game, and the police comes in right after the game and arrest him and take him out of the building, you know. So it just stories after story of things happening, but that's what made that league so tough for guys playing in it, because you had to endure some unbelievable situations.
Former IU star Keith Smart, the guest on One-on-One today. Keith, you've had a lengthy coaching career. I don't think we're going to have time to go into detail on it, but just to kind of summarize it, you turned down a chance to be Bob Knight's assistant coach at IU to become instead the head coach of the Fort Wayne CBA team after you retired from playing at the age of 35. And that led to a job on Randy Whitman's staff with the Cleveland Cavaliers. And then you became the Cavs head coach for a season in 2003. and then spent 7 years as an assistant coach at Golden State, and then replaced Don Nelson as the head coach there, then with the Sacramento as an assistant, and then last season served as the Kings head coach. But in each place, you were coaching a team that really didn't have enough talent to win, and then you got bumped out when a new ownership or management group came in. So really have never had a chance to prove yourself as an NBA coach. So now you're living in the Bay Area again with two boys in high school. Are your sons good players?
Both of them can play. Now my oldest is pretty talented. He knows how to play. He understands it, and didn't play a whole lot his junior year. So right now I'm in the middle of training him, getting him ready for his senior year. And again, being out of the game for this year has allowed me the opportunity to be home with them, and something that I hadn't been able to do over the last couple of years because I was up in Sacramento back and forth because they didn't move. But my youngest one, he might have a shot because he plays everything. He plays football, basketball, he wrestles, he plays golf. He got the gift of all the talent right now. Right now he's at the gym right now. Comes home, does his homework, he goes out and plays. So he might have a shot down the line. My oldest one is probably going to, if he chooses to go into coaching somewhere, because he has a great understanding of how the game should be played.
Okay. What are your boys' names?
Andre is the oldest, and Jared is the youngest.
Jared?
J-R-E-D.
Do they throw in the game tape of IU Syracuse very often to watch?
Well, because they pop on the classic sports that come across.
Yeah, it's hard to miss.
Or someone will say, hey, I saw you on TV last night, and they'll say, we saw you last night. I'm like, where did you see me? And they said, well, you were on TV last night. Or one of their friends, or anytime, someone finds out, I try to be real low-key around here, but someone finds out that one of my sons and that dad played Indiana, so parents will Google me and, be able to pull me up and get all my vitals and bio and everything. So they get a kick out of that from time to time. And my son look at my shorts and he tries to emulate some of the things that I do. So.
They practice that baseline shot falling out
of
bounds?
Oh, yeah. My youngest one said, Dad, I'm going to make one of those shots one day.
I bet.
I'm like, okay.
Yeah. And I'm sure people still want to talk to you about that shot like I've done tonight, but like in airports or whatever when you're traveling with an NBA team or hotels, do you ever get tired of just talking about it?
I'd say I don't because, and no matter where I go, because they're going to see a name tag, if I'm traveling or flying or when I'm coaching and I'm going to a hotel, my name's on my bag. So a guy bring my bag to my room, they start talking about those things. So it happens all the time, and because I'm still around the game. I got to tell you, I came back home, and there's a family that moved into the neighborhood, and she's from Anderson, Indiana.
Mm.
Okay. So her son lives here, and son and daughter-in-law, and have two little kids, and we were getting some stuff brought into the house. So she was walking the grandkids down. And she came out, and I was in the driveway getting something out of the truck. And she said, lo and behold, it is him. My kid said that you lived on this street. And she stood in front of the house and talked to me about her love for IU. Of all the places, on my street in front of my house, this lady was talking about it. And, diehard Indiana fan. Went back to every historical moment in Indiana basketball, so you get those things and I don't tire from it, because I think at that time it was that moment and they had a chance to bump into me and they've been waiting perhaps to bump into me to say something. I've had people say that, I said, if I ever saw you, I would say this, that shot you made, I bumped into a guy, I was back in Bloomington, up in Indianapolis, guy came to me and said, I got to tell you this story. When you guys played that championship game, my daughter was bugging me so much, and I tried to tell her, let daddy watch the game. And he said, if you let daddy watch the game, if Indiana wins the championship, I'll buy you a horse. So he told me this story. I came back, like I said, my in-laws live in Bloomington, so I came back again to Bloomington, and I bumped into this guy. I was doing a function. doing an autograph signing somewhere up at after the mall in Indianapolis. And this guy came up to me. Now he had the little girl who's now a grown lady. And he said, you remember, I don't know if you remember this story, but I told you about my daughter and a horse. Well, here's my daughter. And he said, and I told her the story about when I told her to just be quiet, let me watch the game. If Indiana win, I'll buy her a horse. And so I asked him, said, did he get you the horse? He said, yes, I have the horse. I now have two horses. You know, so
yeah.
It's been pretty remarkable all these years that people still want to talk about it. And I don't, like I said, I don't get frustrated with people because at that particular moment, you know, they get a chance to see me and be around me, and I hear their story, and then I move on, and mm-hmm. we move on.
One-on-One with Keith Smart continues in a moment. All right, thanks to Keith Smart for his doubly generous contribution to the One-on-One archives. You know, we talked nearly long enough to get three shows out of the conversation, so it was difficult to contain his story to two episodes. His journey goes well beyond a single game-winning shot, and as you just heard, he tells it well. So if you missed any of Part 1 or Part 2, go to 1070thefan.com. Click on Shows, click on One-on-One, click on the podcast link, and you can hear it or any of the others in the five-year history of the program. You can reach me by email at mark@1070thefan.com, or you can find me on Facebook and Twitter, with the Twitter handle being @MarkMonteith. And I'll be back again next week, hopefully with another NCAA tournament legend, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.